This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Follow me on X at Bill Bartholomew for breaking news and commentary, and follow Bartholomew Town on Instagram and TikTok. Bartholomew Town is brought to you in part by the University of Rhode Island Online, who offer a wide array of programs. Visit uri.edu/online or give them a call at 401-874-5280. That's 401-874-5280.
I guess you know a little bit, which is the migration and refugees issues.
Yes.
But I wasn't introduced to this kind of topic, like, out of my own will. It was just that. It was thrown at me from my own experience. I don't know if you've heard from her or not, that I am a Syrian refugee. I was born and raised in the cradle of the Syrian Revolution. I was born in a place called Dara. That's where the war started in Syria and the Middle East and from the Arab Spring. And I lived there since the start of the war for 3 years. And after that, we had to move to Jordan as Syrian refugees. And us walking or going to Jordan wasn't pleasant either. We walked from Syria to Jordan in the middle of the night, one night, after our home and village had been stormed by Bashar al-Assad's troops, which is the Syrian government's troops. And we just had nowhere to go, so we just walked to Jordan as Syrian. And then that's when I became a refugee, actually. And that's when I was introduced to the term refugee, and that I had become one. And after that, in Jordan, we lived, obviously, in tents, and for 3 years and a half, in tents and outside the tents, like in the city for 3 years and a half, and we then came to the U.S. And once you are resettled in a developed nation or in a nation where you are expected to become a citizen of that country, you're no longer a refugee. You're called a former refugee. But I think us, my family and I, coming to the U.S. was just a coincidence and also luck. Out of the 10,000 of refugees or Syrian refugees, we were picked to come here. And I thought that was just so much luck. Like, how, of all these people, my family and I were chosen. In 2015, President Obama at the time basically wanted 10,000 Syrian refugees to come to the U.S. And the reason for that is because ISIS was taken over Iraq and Syria very badly. In 2014, ISIS was taken Syria really badly. And in 2015, he made the executive order that he wants, like, to resettle more Syrian refugees. And we were one of those families that got the call from the International Organization for Migration, and we started the process. And on February 25th, 2016, we were the second Syrian refugee to ever resettle in Rhode Island. And it's been a journey ever since, like learning English and integrating ourselves with the culture and trying to find jobs and learn as a whole. But then, the more I learn about the subject, about migration and refugees, the more I am interested in it, the more that I want to involve myself in it. And sometimes I do get sick and tired of talking about it. And I'm like, oh, people, everyone knows about this. Everyone knows about this. But surprisingly, not everyone knows about this. Not everyone knows what's happening or how people get here or how people come here or how people, or why people are here. Like, do you think that Syrians want to be in the U.S.? They had a home of theirs, a beautiful home of theirs. And a revolution happened that kicked them out. And it all comes back to history. And they undermine the topic of displacement, because they just know displacement. They just don't know what happened in the past that caused that displacement, you know? The Palestinian refugees, for example, or the Ukrainian now refugees, or everything. Every refugee or every immigrant in this country had come here of a history that isn't talked about at all, and the U.S. had somehow had a hand in it to begin with.
Right. Well, that's something that I think a lot of people conveniently forget, or they either don't know or they're not interested in knowing, which is that global policy by the dominant powers influence the outcomes of people just like yourselves in probably the most dramatic way. And then, as you said, that landscape suddenly changes. You go through this harrowing journey emerging from the Arab Spring, which frankly a lot of people look at as nothing short of a joyous moment, while there was a lot of consequences with that as well, and a lot of shifting intention, and not always for the better. And so you go through this journey, and your lived experience is, while many people would not even be able to appreciate that remotely, there are hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, around the world who have that similar feeling of displacement and a need for, using this word lightly, but resettlement.
Resettlement, 100%. I do call Rhode Island home. I've been living here for 8 years now, and Rhode Island, I was just thinking of getting a necklace map of Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. I guess it has given me the place that I yearned for, a place of safety and a place of opportunities. And URI and Rhode Island has given me all of that, like the opportunity and the safety. And that's basically what I call home. A home is something that you love, and something that can give you opportunities, and something that can nurture, or something that can take care of you as a baby. And I think that's what happened. I feel like I grew here, and I grew much stronger to like what I like and do what I want to do.
How old were you when the process began, when it was absolutely necessary for you to take that harrowing journey in the middle of the night and leave your, you know, home?
Yeah. In 2013, that was December of 2012. That's when we like left our house, and we were displaced in a mosque in a nearby city, because we had gotten the news that our home would be stormed very shortly and that we needed to leave. And at the time, our home was a shelter for all of our village, all of our people, because our home, we weren't poor in Syria. We had good money, and our home was in a place where it was very safe, because it was surrounded by trees and it's safe. It's hard for them to get into. That's the moral of the story. And when we got that news that they'll come in and storm our home, us and literally the whole entire village in our house had to flee our home. And that's in December. So we all went to a mosque in a nearby city. And in that nearby city, the whole mosque was full of other people that left their homes. And the mosque was just packed. Everyone had the same idea that, let's go to a mosque. No one will bomb a mosque. It's a mosque. At the end of the day, why would you, you know? It's a place of shelter. It's a place of worship. And each family took a corner in that home. Oh, I'm sorry, in that mosque, which later on became like a home. And 2 weeks in, we got the news that the SS troops will be bombing mosques soon, and that the mosque is no longer safe, and we need to escape. We basically decided that same day, my dad and my mom, and they were like, okay, at night that day, we're going to be walking to Jordan. So we all just literally, I didn't know what walking to Jordan. I didn't know what, like, where is Jordan? I didn't know. I was in 2013. And I told you, in December of 2012, that's when we escaped. So we witnessed January 1st of 2013 in the mosque, by the way. So we stayed there for a little while. I'm not sure how long, but that's the moral of the story, that 2013, we witnessed it in the mosque. And after that, we just started walking. Us and literally tens of other families And that walk took 3 hours plus a little bit of a car ride by some of the smugglers, the people that were taking us, that we paid them. And later on at the border, that's when the Jordanian border or the Jordanian military or police welcomed us. And because they knew there were going to be a flood of refugees coming all at once. And basically they put us all in tent. They took all of our identification cards, like passports or IDs. So everything that said that we were Syrian was taken from us. And because there was so much flood of Syrian refugees that they didn't take good care of them. So to this day, we don't have our Syrian IDs or birth certificates because they were taken from us at the Jordanian border. And we stayed there for a while. And after that, we escaped to the city of Jordan. And like I said, in 2014-2015, President Obama basically wanted more Syrian refugees to come here, and I was resettled in the U.S. at the age of 14.
Wow. Yeah. One thing that is, there's so much to this, that your story is just so important for people to hear, and I think so many people have, you know, immigration has become a hot button issue, and mostly because it's been used as sort of a political weapon.
Yeah.
But lost is the one by one story of people, as you said, who have left their home. As you said, Rhode Island has become a home for you. You've done quite well at the University of Rhode Island. You're a triple major. You're about to go to Zimbabwe for an internship at the U.S. Embassy. You're receiving an undergraduate academic excellent award next week. You are a Rhodes finalist. I mean, you're crushing it when it comes to the work you're doing academically. And also, through your experience, you've been able to share about the journey of Syrian refugees in general. But your takeaway, something I thought was really interesting, was there's a notion that, or there's maybe even data to support, that women are finding more success post-resettlement than men. Why do you think that is?
I'll tell you why. So that was my honors project, in which I conducted interviews with Syrian refugee families, and that was a mix of men and women and so on and so forth. And that's something I focused on during my Truman Scholarship application, which I also won for Rhode Island. And the reason, it's not something I find it, it's just the interviews that found the results, in which it suggests that women are much more likely to be successful after or post resettlement in the U.S. than men. And the reason for that is because of cultural expectations. Women are typically not expected to work and provide for the family. They're not expected to work and provide for the family. They can work, yes, of course, 100%. I mean, personally, I work. I have been working my whole life, even in Jordan, like to assist my family back then. But generally speaking, on a huger or a bigger scope, women are not expected to work to provide for the family. On the other hand, men are expected to provide for the family. They are religiously obligated to do so, like through Islam. Islam asks men to provide for the family because Islam understands that men have a safer environment for them to work, and understands that men tend to get paid more, or they get more opportunities, and so on and so forth. And when we were resettled in the U.S. Or in Rhode Island, men and women, all of us basically, are provided with English courses. And if you are above the age of 18, you are encouraged to find a job. So when these men are resettled, or if they're even if they're 18 years old, which that's the circumstances of my own family, both of my brothers were above the age of 18, like literally slightly by months and by 1 year, they were encouraged to find a job, and they found a job a month in. So they weren't even able to finish their English courses. On the other hand, women tend to finish their English courses because they are not obligated to find a job, and that's good for them. They don't find a job, so they stick with their English courses. And afterwards, they learn about opportunities from the environments they immerse themselves in, such as Dorcas. That's where they learn that there you can get a GED, you can get an associate degree, you can do this, you can do that. And on the other hand, men tend to immerse themselves in a job where it's not you don't need to speak English in that job. And most likely or more likely for you to not even speak English at all. And therefore, you're not learning English. You're sticking to your mother tongue. And this is the sixth eye, literally, or that conclusion, I could swear that it's the same thing for all immigrants. I'm not even joking. That come from certain cultures, like Central Asians. Like if you're from Uzbekistan, I feel like the same thing will be happening. Or you're from Mexico, or I don't know where you're coming from, but I feel like this statistics could be the same for other people. The moral of the story is that same thing. Women are more likely to get their education because they're not obligated to find a job. But you would think it's the opposite. You would think, oh my God, oh, they're oppressing their own nation, quote unquote. They don't allow them to study. They don't allow them to learn. Yada, yada, yada. But when they come here, they're succeeding. And I don't want to take myself as a success story, but other people, other Syrian refugees here, women, are a huge success story. Like they study computer science or dental hygiene, or they're amazing and they're doing their work. And sometimes I mourn that. I mourn and yarn that our own brains and our own minds and our own talents are in the U.S. when there's so many other people like us in the U.S. The U.S. does not need us. What needs us is our home. Our home could have had my friend's brain who studies computer science, or my other friends who studying dental hygiene, or the other Syrian refugee who's literally going to become a doctor, or even me who got into Oxford. You know, the U.S. does not need me, does not need me in any form. However, the displaced people are what in need of me in the future. I could become something that could help them. And if I ever to do anything for refugees in general, specifically in Rhode Island, is to help men, believe it or not, is to help men get their education and get their opportunities up, because they are lost as if the U.S. has dehumanized them. Those refugees or displaced people. And we can see right now within the Palestinian move in which the men of Palestine have been dehumanized. They always highlight, oh, 17,000 Palestinian women have killed. Yes, that's amazing to highlight. Women are vulnerable and the most vulnerable in times of war. However, why is it so lightly mentioned about the men that have been kidnapped, literally raped by Israeli occupation forces, and literally tortured just by CNN. CNN just released one report about that.
Yeah. Finally, a mainstream media outlet is, I think, because of a shifting public understanding, willing to tackle that very broad and extremely important issue. But you're right that it is, it's been buried, and it's been buried intentionally as part of a broader strategy.
Exactly.
Lena, where can people find out more about the work you're doing? Do you have any sort of social media that, or if anyone's hearing this right now, I'm looking out my window at Dorcas, and I'm thinking that there are probably a lot of people that would love to connect with you. How can they do so?
So I do not work with Dorcas. I am still a student, graduating soon, obviously. But they can find me personally if they want to email me at Lena, which my first name, Lena, and my first last name, Altaan, Altaan, 060@gmail.com. And my phone number is 401-516-4260. I'm happy to chat with anyone or anyone that has questions, or even people who want to apply for scholarships. I love doing that. So I'm happy to connect.
Lena, thank you so much for your time this morning. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for sharing your story. And it's something that I think a lot of people will be pleased to connect with you on. And it's bold. It's harrowing. It's something that's misunderstood. It's been politicized. And you're an inspiration to so many people, myself included. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for your time, too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bartholomew Town is brought to you in part by Navigant Credit Union. As Rhode Island's first ever member-owned credit union, Navigant Credit Union has been a staple in the local business community for more than 108 years. Today, Navigant is a $3.4 billion institution serving more than 136,000 members across 25 physical branch locations. But since its founding in 1915, The mission has never changed. Navigant Credit Union's team of financial professionals have remained committed to improving the financial well-being of the families, businesses, and communities they serve across Rhode Island. Learn more at NavigantCU.org. We're also brought to you by Rhode Island Media Group, home of The Independent, Southern Rhode Island Newspapers, The Westerly Sun, and The Call and Times. They have local news coverage that you can't find anywhere else. Get in-depth local sports, events, and news coverage straight from the sources you trust. If it's hyper-local news you're looking for, give them a call at 401-789-9744, press 1, and you can subscribe to the print or digital versions of your local news providers at Rhode Island Media Group.